From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. A recent U.S. Supreme Court decision ruled in favor of the family of a Florida landowner against the St. Johns River Water Management District. In a case that wound its way through the courts for nearly two decades, the family sued the district over wetlands use restrictions. Supporters call it a win for private landowners, but what will it mean for Florida's dwindling wetland habitat? We'll take a closer look. Plus, Frontline and ProPublica's program, Life and Death in Assisted Living, premiered Tuesday on PBS. We recently caught up with the correspondent behind the year-long investigation into the nation's assisted living industry. We'll also explore efforts here in Florida to reform how the industry is regulated. First, this news.
This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm Valerie Alker. Thanks for joining us. On today's program, WGCU's John Davis talks with journalist A.C. Thompson about what he uncovered in a year-long investigation into the country's assisted living facility industry. Thompson is a correspondent for Frontline and ProPublica's Life and Death in Assisted Living, which premiered Tuesday on WGCU television and other public television stations. Also joining us will be State Senator Eleanor Sobel of Hollywood and Family for Better Care Director Brian Lee for a closer look at efforts to pass assisted living facility reforms in the Florida legislature. But first, Florida's wetlands. According to numbers from the Department of the Interior, Florida has lost 9.3 million acres of wetlands over the past 200 years. Between 1953 and 1973, 1.44 million acres of wetlands were developed. In the early days, it was seen as carving civilization out of a swamp. Then the environmental movement emerged, quickly followed by the passage of the Clean Water Act in 1972. In 1988, President George H.W. Bush was behind the establishment of a no-net-loss wetlands policy. Since then, wetlands destruction has slowed, but still takes place under government restrictions and supervision. But earlier this year, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, sided with a Central Florida property owner who had wanted to build on a 15-acre plot outside Orlando. Coy Kuntz sued the St. Johns River Water Management District for making the development permit contingent on restoring wetlands it owned, which were several miles away. Kuntz, who since died, first took legal action in 1994, and the case worked its way to the nation's highest court. Following the decision, the Miami Herald headline read, "Supreme Court gives landowners a big win in Florida case." But how big is the win? Here to talk with us about wetlands, wetland mitigation, and related land use policy, we welcome in our studio Jennifer Hecker, Director of Natural Resource Policy for the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you for having us.
And on the phone from Boca Raton, land and water use attorney John Fumero of the law firm Sundstrom, Friedman & Fumero. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Valerie.
And we welcome your input as well. You can join our conversation, 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can send an email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Let's start with you, Jennifer. In the Kuntz case, the landowner was asked to balance developing part of his property with off-site mitigation. First, explain what that is, how frequently it's done, and why, in this case, the landowner said no.
Well, part of the Clean Water Act is to avoid impacts to wetlands, understanding the value that wetlands provide us in the form of flood storage, water quality improvement, recharging our aquifers, our groundwater supply. So the decision here, you know, was very typical of how the agencies handle impacts to wetlands in that they ask the applicant to avoid and minimize their impacts to those wetlands. And then whatever impacts that are unavoidable are to be mitigated, meaning offset. And in this case, you know, the landowner had offered to offset with other wetlands on site. But if you take, for instance, 10 acres of wetlands and you develop half and then save the other half, you still are down half of the wetlands. And the agency correctly said that that doesn't actually offset appropriately. You need to either create more wetlands or restore some degraded wetlands off site to help offset the loss of those wetlands on site. And that is very typical of the agencies, and that is in accordance with federal and state policy.
John Fumero, an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, which represented in the Coots case, was quoted in the Herald as saying, quote, anyone who owns a home or a business and wants to make use of it, they will no longer be subject to willy-nilly extortion demands from permitting agencies. Does this decision wipe out wetlands protections? And in your opinion, what does it do?
No, it does not wipe out wetland protections. We are lucky here in Florida in that we have some of the most progressive wetland regulatory programs in the nation. And we have a very unique system here. And I believe this decision will really not have any meaningful impact on how government regulates impacts to wetlands. It was a nice media snippet, but the truth is this case is very unique, very factually limited to the circumstances here, and I don't think it will have any far-reaching precedential impact or negative impact on our ability to regulate wetlands.
Since the Great Recession, which brought building to a halt in many areas of Florida, we haven't been reading about too many challenges to wetland use restrictions. But as the economy recovers, do you think that could change, John?
Certainly. Look, we in Florida, when you look at the various agencies and local governments that are involved in looking at wetlands and wetland impacts associated with development, typically we have tens of thousands of permit decisions that are made every year in Florida by regulatory agencies. That has slowed down, but it will be picking up again. And when it picks up again, you will see a little bit more of this kind of activity in these kind of cases. But keep in mind, when at the height of the real estate development in Florida, you didn't see these types of challenges because developers were flush with cash, making a great deal of money, and rarely would object to these permits. 99.9% of the permit decisions, the tens of thousands of permit decisions made every year, are challenged.
Jennifer, the Conservancy, you wanted to comment on that first.
Well, I do think that this is somewhat exceptional, and the way that we see it, I mean, it's somewhat exceptional because the agencies rarely deny a permit. Between 1999 and 2003, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which is in charge of federal wetlands permitting, approved 12,000 wetland permits and rejected only one. So the fact that anyone's ever told no and thus has any reason to challenge is very rare. Unfortunately, since the no net loss policy has taken effect in 1990 to 2005, that 15-year period following that policy taking effect, we lost 84,000 acres of wetlands in Florida from development only, without counting impacts from mining and agriculture. So, you know, unfortunately, we're still sustaining an immense amount of wetland loss, and it's very rare that the agencies have the political will and backing and support from the leadership to deny permits where those impacts are inappropriate.
The Conservancy was born out of a grassroots effort to stop plans to build a road through Rookery Bay. That was in 1964. In your opinion, how important have regulations governing the use of wetlands influenced growth here in Southwest Florida and the rest of the state?
They're incredibly important. You know, as we continue to see development push into lower and lower wetland areas, we are impacting our water supply negatively, lowering water tables, lessening the amount of freshwater storage on land and under the ground. So there is a balancing act that needs to be done, and these agencies are really our only checks and balances to ensure that development is not completely incompatible with other public uses and needs.
John, looking at the other side of the coin, do you think onerous wetlands use restrictions have stunted growth?
No, not at all. I think in Florida, again, we have a very progressive regulatory program. And I should note that the flagship regulatory program in Florida, called the Environmental Resource Permit Program, did not even exist when the Coons decision made its way through the court system. So we have a much more comprehensive and detailed regulatory system in place today that did not exist in 1994 when Koontz filed his permit application. That's another reason why I don't think there's really a far-reaching negative precedent. Jennifer's right. Wetlands are critical resources around the world and certainly in Florida. Florida is a peninsula. We're surrounded by water, and water and wetland protection is critical. However, I don't see that any of these types of decisions really having an impact on how Florida regulates wetlands. So I'm hopeful that this will not really change the way agencies do business or somehow hamstring them from doing what they typically do in the permitting program. The only footnote I would make here is that in this Koontz decision, I think the real issue was the fact that back in the 1990s, agencies had what they called pay-and-go programs. These were programs where, as part of your wetland mitigation proposal, landowners would write a check to the state and say, here's $10,000, here's $50,000, go ahead and use this, state, for wetland acquisition programs and wetland protection programs. Those pay-and-go programs don't exist anymore. And that was really a centerpiece of the Supreme Court's decision here. And factually, those programs just don't exist here.
Instead, we have mitigation banks. Is that correct?
That's right. Mitigation banks have really taken the place. And I was general counsel at South Florida Water Management District when the original Koontz decision was made. And in those days, we all, the agencies, we all had pay-and-go programs. And the reason was because we didn't have mitigation banks at that time. Today we do, and therefore these pay-and-go programs are obsolete.
Do you think sometimes the definition of what's a wetland is too strict? I remember one time a church in the Tampa Bay area was trying to develop a parking lot, half acre, and this was back in the 90s, and there was a big flap about their wanting to do that because some wetland plants were discovered there, and their attorney said that they thought at the time that, you know, what the definition of a wetland was too strict. Has that changed over time?
The definition has not changed in any meaningful way, Valerie, but what I will say is this. I think the science of wetland delineation, the science of wetland mitigation has developed enormously, certainly over the last 20 years, to a point where I don't really think you see those types of arbitrary decisions being made today. There typically isn't a substantial dispute over what is a wetland and what is not a wetland, because the science is at a point now where it's very clear what constitutes a wetland and what is not a wetland. We used to see those battles 20 years ago, but today, not very many.
I mentioned some big numbers earlier, 9.3 million acres of wetlands over the past 200 years. I'm wondering, Jennifer, do you know this? What percentage of Florida was that? Was much of the state considered swamp?
Yes. Yeah, so when they look at what is a wetland, they're looking not just at plants, but also the hydrology and the soils. So, you know, there's a combination of factors that determine whether an area is technically a wetland. And the majority of the state, especially the southern half of the state, were historically wetlands. And many of those have been drained, obviously, with the canal systems we have in place. But we still have some remaining intact flowways, and these areas are absolutely critical to our water supply. So as we move into those areas and continually develop in these lower and lower wetland areas, we really are doing ourselves a disservice. And that is what these regulations are designed to protect and make sure that where those impacts occur, that there are appropriate offsets. And the money was being used to provide offsets and providing resources to acquire other wetlands and restore hydrology and build freshwater storage and filtration in other areas. So it is appropriate. And, you know, in the case of the Koontz case, you know, I think what we see as a potential unintended consequence is that the agencies, you know, which are often pressured to never deny a permit, will not have the flexibility to offer a variety of options to landowners anymore. And trying to assist them in finding ways to make a project permittable. And so, you know, of course, that could result in them deciding to deny a permit. Unfortunately, I think the political reality is that's very unlikely. So our concern is that they're going to be pushed to approve permits without appropriate offsets, without mitigation, and we will see the acceleration of the impacts of that.
So my next question was, and I guess you would say, let me pose it to you, John, first, and then Jennifer, you can answer. Can the state support more growth without the destruction of more wetlands?
Well, that's a very involved question, but the answer is yes. There is a way to do it in a responsible fashion so that we maintain the most critical resources and ensure that when there are impacts, resource impacts, those impacts are fully mitigated and offset. And at the end of the day, there's a net gain. And I think that can be done in a responsible fashion. We live in a state that has a very advanced system of water management districts that regulate wetlands. And by and large, they do a good job. We can always look and see instances where they may not have been done the appropriate thing, but by and large, we have a system in Florida that works, that does protect wetlands. But keep in mind, the three of us all likely live in an area where that was historically wetlands.
That's my house.
Yes. A house. And that's the reality of living in the southern half of Florida, that is a peninsula, that most of which was inundated. At least the southern half was. So that's the reality. Not all wetlands are high-grade wetlands that are threatened and endangered species habitat. Some wetlands are degraded. Some wetlands don't provide meaningful resource value. Those wetlands can be mitigated, and mitigation can actually provide greater values. And so there is a way, to answer your question, in which we can accommodate reasonable development and protect Florida's wetlands.
Jennifer, I've been to the wetland mitigation area between Matt Lachey and Pine Island. I think it's Little Pine Island, that strip there. And they have done some really good work there in restoring that. Have you been out there before?
Yes, and there's a lot of areas where that's occurring, but the bottom line is that we're still losing more than we're offsetting. And I think that to answer your previous question, you know, we're seeing death by a thousand cuts and reductions to our water supply. I think we, during dry periods now, realize that because we're constantly experiencing different types of watering restrictions that indicate water shortage. So there is a point at which we need to make a decision of, you know, how do we protect our existing residents? By continuing to allow more communities to be built in these areas, we are creating additional impacts and reduction of services, creating additional costs to existing residents who have to pay for alternative water supply development and things of that nature. So it's important to realize that we need to balance those things, and I do think that more needs to be done to protect wetlands. We're still seeing hundreds and hundreds of acres a year being lost in our Southwest Florida counties. So these policies are, in our view, not stringent, not protective enough of these critical resources.
I've heard of some building projects moving forward on small wetland areas where the owner decided it was cheaper to pay the fine than deal with the bureaucratic hurdles. Do either of you think making it easier for these small projects to move forward would, in the end, result in more compliance? John?
Yes, and we do see efforts to do just that. When a project is relatively small and below a certain impact threshold, there are expedited ways in which that project can get permitted. We want our agencies, we want our government employees to focus on the projects that have big impacts. That's where I want their time spent, not on small projects in urbanized areas. So, you know, it's really kind of a triage approach. You know, focus on those permits and those projects that really have a potential impact that's meaningful. And let's get those projects permitted in a proper fashion. Let's not get lost in the weeds on those projects that really have no meaningful impact or impacting wetlands that are surrounded by development and really have no value. Let's focus on the wetlands that have real value. Let's protect them. Let's ensure that many of them are brought into the public domain.
Jennifer?
I think that what we've seen in policy shifts in the past few years has been directives to the agencies to really grant permits almost at any cost. And landowners understand that and have additional leverage now that they didn't have a few years ago, which results in them not cooperating with the agencies, you know, to provide appropriate offsets and things of that nature. And with the agencies being in a position where they ultimately know that they are, you know, expected to grant that permit, it really limits their ability, you know. And so, and there is also very little support for any type of enforcement if there is lack of compliance. So I think that their abilities are very limited, and we need to do more as citizens to, you know, elect leadership that understands the importance of wetlands and to provide these agencies the support to do their jobs properly so that we can protect not only wetlands, but our own interests in our own water supply and our quality of life here.
In the last few years, both the Florida Department of Environmental Regulation and the Department of Community Affairs have undergone downsizing. What kind of message does this send to the environmental community, Jennifer?
Well, the political directives have been really that environmental regulation is perceived as a negative thing and that it's hampering economic growth and development. And we see it quite the reverse. I mean, the environmental regulation is promoting a quality of life that draws millions of people to Florida, that attracts people to buy homes down here. If we allow our waters to become very polluted, we have limited water supply, ultimately that is going to hamper our economic growth and development more than anything else.
And John, what kind of message does this send to builders?
Well, I think that there is a message that agencies need to be mindful of, and that is that when you require mitigation and offsets from a permit applicant, we need to make sure that there is a reasonable nexus between the impact that is being regulated and what we are requiring of the permit applicant. And I continue to believe that in almost the majority of cases, in 99.9% of the cases, that is in fact being done. And I certainly agree with Jennifer. We know now more.
We got to go. John, we are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Jennifer Hecker, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.